All right, so my name's Bill Sullivan. I am an emergency physician. I work at 3 different hospitals. I work in a small rural hospital about 90 miles southwest of Chicago. I work in a medium-sized hospital in Indiana, and I work every once in a while I work at University of Illinois. So I work at a rural hospital. I work at a Midwest, like a urban hospital, and I work at a community hospital. So I got kind of a good idea of what goes on in all three. In addition, I do law, so I practice law. My most of the stuff I do is contract reuse. So I've probably done in my career at least 600. So I also review contracts. So I've gone through about 600 contracts in my career, which has been since the year 2000. So I've got a good idea of what's in contracts, what should be in contracts, and what shouldn't be in contracts. So the two things we're going to talk about today. One is we're going to talk about what you guys need to look at when you're looking for a job. And the other thing is, once you decide here's some place they may want to work, we're going to talk about what types of things that are in contracts that you might want to change and negotiate out of the contracts. So this is just an outline of what we're going to talk about. First is we're going to talk about is how you decide on a position. What types of things that you look for once you decide on potential positions. Then we're going to talk about what you go through in the interview process, because everybody's going to go through an interview. If they like you, then we're going to talk about what you go through in the contract negotiation, and then just a few negotiating points. So what are the types of things that you look at in a position? And the thing is, it's kind of like, what do you look at when buying a car? Some people want a race car that goes real fast. Some people want a car that gets good gas mileage. Some people want a car that's green, that it's, they're looking at a Tesla that doesn't use any gas. Or some people need a minivan because they got a big family. So there is no right answer to say, what do you look at in a contract? It's really, the important point is you have to decide about what you are looking for before you actually go and look for it. So some of the types of things you should consider are location. Some people say, I've got to be close to my family. I have to live in this state, or I have to live in this town. That's severely going to limit them in terms of what they can ask for in the contract. What about travel time? Personally, I don't like working in the same area where I practice medicine, because I don't want to be the one that has to code my next door neighbor's kid and forever be associated with, you killed my kid. So I don't like working anywhere near where I practice or where I live. So travel time, I like keeping things like a good 45 minutes away from where I live. What kind of neighborhood is it? Are you concerned if there's in a bad neighborhood, inner city versus a rural area? Payment's important. So some people want to earn as much money as they can, but the trade-off is if they're paying you $300 an hour, you're not going to be sitting around checking the internet. You're going to be running your whole shift. You're going to have to hit the ground running every time you work there. Is that the trade-off you want? Some people say yes, some people say no. Academic versus non-academic, what type of work environment? Do you want something that's a high-volume emergency department, or do you want something that's a little easier, low-volume, where you can actually take a breather every now and then? And then advancement, some people want to get into the partnership track. Is that available? Because if that's something you're looking for and they don't have that, then you may not want to work at that that hospital. So deciding on a position mostly ends up being needs versus wants. So needs are things that you have to have or you won't sign the contract. So if family's important to you and you got to live near your family, I need a contract in this state, in this town, or I'm not going to sign it. That's a need. Now that may not be a need for somebody else, but it may be your need. So that's something you have to determine in advance. Sometimes I call them deal breakers, that if you don't get that, you're not going to sign the contract. And then there's wants. Wants are things you'd like to have, but you still sign the contract if you don't get them. But they'd be nice to have. So you try to negotiate those into the contract if you can. And the important point about this is make sure you know what you're looking for before you go looking for a contract. Just the same way you research a car before you go buy a car. Make sure you know what you're looking for before you go find a contract. Interviewing. So I survive around here because I understand the pecking order, sir. The purpose of the interview, once you determine that you may want to work someplace, the purpose of the interview is to get to know each other, exchange information. Would this person be a good fit? So you're looking to say, okay, what makes the hospital special where I may want to work there? And they're looking to say, okay, what makes this person special that I may want to have them come and work for us? So both sides are feeling each other out. So the hospital, the director saying, is this person going to be a good fit for us? Are there any downsides to hiring this person? They have a past that we don't want to have to deal with. What's a little commitment? Are they just going to come here and do a couple shifts and then leave, or work for 6 months to get their foot into somewhere else and leave? Or are they going to stick with their hospital? Because recruitment costs are high. And the flip side is the candidate's going to want to know, why is this hospital a good place for me? Am I going to get along here? And does this position meet all my needs and my wants? So hospitals, when you're looking for a hospital, what they're looking for in a potential position is somebody that's a team player. They have a good attitude. They're committed to the hospital, their group. And this is kind of tough because half of you guys are going to change jobs in the first 2 years. That's just the way it goes. Half of you are going to find a different job. So they want someone that's going to be committed to their group. Being involved in hospital activities, it's nice to just go and do your 12 hours and leave, but sometimes they want you to be involved in hospital committees and hospital groups because that improves the group status with the hospital, and that's something that the hospital is looking for, is an interactive group. So you may have to be committed to those type of things. And then if you happen to have other special qualities, like you're involved in state committees, which is always a good idea, like being a member of ICEP and being on a committee at ICEP is something that may set you apart from another candidate. If you're good at ultrasound, or if you have a tox background, or if you have legal knowledge, those are all things that may set you apart from other candidates that may get your foot in the door further than someone else's. Those candidates who most closely fit the hospital needs are going to be the ones most likely to have a job offer. So you have to think about what's important to you during the interview too, and this is the time for you to get information from the hospital. What's the patient flow like? How often are there patients being held in the emergency departments? Is there CT? How hard is it to get an MRI? One of the places I work, it takes like a blessing from the CEO of the hospital before you can order an MRI in the middle of the night. How hard is it to do that? Do they use physician extenders? What about the support of the group? What type of EMR? I know there's certain EMRs I can't say, well, what phrase that? I can't stand any EMR. There are certain ones that I hate more than others, but that may be something you consider when you decide whether or not you want to sign with the hospital. Scheduling, how they're paid, and benefits, if there are any. Some places offer a lot of benefits, some places don't. So once you get to the interview, it's an opportunity for you to talk to other people to see whether or not this place is going to be a good fit with you. So it's not just a matter of talking to the administrator, whoever's taking you around the hospital, but see if you can pull aside like the charge nurse and just say, hey, you know, what's it like here? How are the doctors here? Do you guys get along well? How many doctors have left in the past 6 months? How many nurses have left in the past 6 months? If you've got three doctors and six nurses that have all bailed in the past 6 months, you may reconsider whether or not you want to work at that hospital, at least until you figure out why everybody's leaving. A point of note, just in general, is when you go to these interviews, and if they're very unreasonable or rigid to say, no, we don't do that, we can't do that here, that's supposed to be the honeymoon period where they're trying to get you to like them and they're trying to like you. If they're being very rigid and standoffish when you're doing your interview, things aren't going to get better if you decide to sign the contract there. So that should be a big red flag for you if that happens. Okay. So what are some of the things that hospitals can offer in terms of enticing you to come and work there? One is loan repayment, and you don't see it a lot, but especially in rural hospitals, they may say, we're going to give you, $50,000 towards your loan repayment. Now, in order to keep that money, you have to work with us for X number of years, otherwise you have to pay it back. But they may offer partial loan forgiveness. They may offer you a signing bonus, but it may come with the same string attached. We're going to give you $20,000 to sign the contract. But if you don't stay here for 2 years, you have to pay it all back, or you have to pay it back on a prorated basis. A lot of places will offer moving expenses. So if you're going to take the leap of faith to say, I'm going to move halfway across the country to come and work at this hospital, they'll reimburse you for your moving expenses. That's something that you should request if you're going to be moving. Stipends, sometimes if you agree to take like an EMS director position, or if you're going to be a medical director, they'll give you an added stipend in addition to your hourly salary. Academic appointments, if you're going the academic route, that's something you should make sure that you get. As we mentioned before, if they do give you these benefits, a lot of times they have string attached where they want to try to have you stay there for more than a year. And just as an aside, if you are asking for too much, if they're saying we're gonna offer you $150 an hour, you say, no, I want $250 an hour, they may just say, you know what, there's other people, forget it. So you kind of have to draw a fine line between knowing what's reasonable and asking for too much. Okay, so contract negotiation. Now you've decided on a contract, now we go to the contract itself. A lot of places, not all places, will send you a pre-employment letter. And all that means is that they're trying to lock you into some of the terms without committing you to the contract, just so you don't argue about them later. So I got an example of a pre-employment letter here, and I don't know how well you can see it. I can see it. Basically, it's just a one-page letter. This one says you're going to work 40-hour work weeks. You'll expect to work 32 clinical hours and do 8 hours of department activities, and you're going to be paid this much money. So those are just general terms, and you're asked to sign it at the bottom that you agree to those terms. All that does is it takes those things off the table later on. If you want to negotiate a contract, you can't go back and say, well, you offered me $200,000, I want $250,000. They're going to bring out this letter and say, you already agreed to the $200,000 spot. So these pre-employment letters are, they kind of just set the stage, they set the basis for the agreement. If you sign one of these and later on you decide I'm going to work somewhere else, they're not binding on you. You don't have to go through the contract. This is just agreeing on basic terms. So once you sign the pre-employment letter, then they may give you a contract. So I'm going to go through, and there are lots of contract terms. I'm not doing a half hour talk, which is a little less because of these computers, is not going to, it's going to scratch the surface of all the different types of things. So I'm just going to go through some of the basic stuff. All contracts will have a term. Usually it's 1 to 2 years. If they got you into a 5-year contract and they don't let you get out, then you got to ask yourself, why? Are they having trouble finding people? Why do you want to lock me in for 5 years? Most of the places, if they've got the 1 to 2 year contract term, will have automatic renewal. So you don't have to sign a new contract every year. It's called an evergreen clause. So that's standard in a contract. Contract duties. What are the physician's responsibilities? Sometimes they'll just say you're going to practice emergency medicine, which is good. Sometimes they give you a contract term that'll give you duties that last 3 pages long. And that can be a problem because if you don't adhere to every one of those duties, and I'm sorry, if you don't adhere to every one of those duties, you can be in breach of contract and they can terminate you for breach of contract. So the more duties you have, the more they try to micromanage you, the more you run the risk of not being able to fulfill those duties, and then you're subject to termination. So it's best to try to minimize those in a contract if you can. It's not that you're not going to practice good medicine, it's just that we don't need to be performing to be on the hook for performing quarterly drug physicals on patients and employees, and providing community services at the will of the hospital, all these other things that aren't usually part of an emergency physician's duties. Compensation. Of course, sir, this is just a ballpark figure. Some considerations with compensation. Should you be an employee? Should you be an independent contractor? That may be something that you consider when you sign the contract. Do I want to be an employee or do I want to be an independent contractor? Independent contractors are good because you have a lot more tax write-offs. But the flip side is you have to pay self-employment tax, which takes a bigger hit out of your income. Employees are good because there's a lot of employee benefits that you might get where you wouldn't get those as an independent contractor. So, but generally employees get paid a little less. So there's give and take in terms of whether or not you should be an employee versus independent contractor, and that's something that if you're interested in, you talk about it with a tax advisor. Salary versus hourly. A lot of academic institutions will pay you based on a salary, but you have to work a minimum number of hours. And you're not going to, if you're getting paid a certain amount every year, you're not going to be able to slack off and kick your feet up. They're going to want to make sure that you have, that you're producing for the salary that you're getting paid. So one of the things you have to ask about salaries, does it include benefits? Because they may say, we're going to offer you a salary of $200,000, but that includes our estimate of your health insurance, which is $25,000 a year. That includes your malpractice insurance, which is another $20,000 a year, and that includes disability insurance, which is another $10,000. So all of a sudden it goes from you're getting $200,000 a year down to you're taking home $140,000. So make sure that the salary that they quote you does, or make sure you know whether it does or doesn't include benefits. Sometimes the contracts will have incentives, so if you agree to work nights and weekends, they may give you more money. They also may have a production bonus where, I don't know if you guys are familiar with RVUs, but basically you get paid more based upon the complexity of the patient that you see. So that may be something else that's in the contract. Signing bonus versus a loan, sometimes I kind of hinted at this before, they'll give you a signing bonus, say we're going to give you a $20,000 signing bonus, but then they may consider it a loan that you have to pay back unless you stay with them for a certain number of years, and they may just slip that in the contract somewhere, just kind of something to keep an eye out for. And then benefits, sometimes they may say you're going to get benefits, but then when you look further in the contract, you're the one paying for all them, so they're not really benefits, it's you're paying for what everybody else would pay for, and you're just doing it through their system. So they're not really benefits per se, because you're paying for them. Contract termination. It's kind of weird to talk about termination before you even sign a contract, but that's probably one of the biggest things to consider. So most contracts keep going, and they have this evergreen clause. They keep going until the contract is terminated by one of the parties. And there's a lot of ways that you can terminate a contract. Now, sit back and think for a second. Why do parties terminate a contract? Why is a hospital going to terminate a contract? If you're getting along well, you're treating the patients well, you're doing your good, doing a job, are they going to want to get rid of you? No. They're going to say, hospital's going to want to get rid of somebody for a couple reasons. Either the group's going to lose the contract, and then they're going to have to get rid of the employees. Or the employee is causing problems. Either they're not providing good medical care, they're not getting along with the medical staff, the nurses don't like them. So basically, a hospital is going to want to get rid of a doctor for one of only a couple reasons. Either the doctor's a problem or the group loses the contract. So in both those cases, those would be probably fall into the for-cause termination. Why would doctors want to leave a hospital? They get a better offer, there's a job issue, there's a family issue. So there's a bunch of reasons that a doctor would want to leave a hospital. So those are usually contained within the without cause termination. So when we get down to talk about this next thing here, for cause terminations are immediate. You walk into work, they say, we're gonna have security escort you to your locker so you can get your things, and you're leaving. That's a for cause termination. Or you may get a letter in the mail saying, don't come to work, you've been terminated, or a phone call. So for cause terminations are immediate. So you wanna try to limit the amount of those, reasons for which you can be terminated for cause. What's the problem with for-cause terminations? Medicine is unique. In order to get a job somewhere, you have to apply for staff privileges, go through credentialing, pull all these things, go through the meetings, and then finally get your staff privileges. How long does that take? Like 3 months. If you're a nurse and you get fired, you can go work at another hospital the next day with orientation. Doctor takes several months. So you want to try to, if you get fired for-cause and you don't have staff privileges somewhere else, you're going to take a 3-month hit in your salary. So it is very important to try to limit the reasons for which you can be terminated for cause. Without cause, then you have to give notice. Usually it's 30 to 90 days notice. You want to try to have 60 days is a sweet spot. So without cause termination, 60 days is good. You want to try to prevent subjective language in for cause terminations, meaning they can terminate you immediately for any reason. So like engages in unprofessional conduct. And I don't know how well you can see it here, but this is just one contract where I pulled that got like, what, 13, more than 13, because it went onto a second page, all the reasons for which they can terminate you for cause. One of which is failure to refusal or inability to comply with the policies and protocols of the employer, which may establish from time to time. So they may not even be part of the contract initially. They may establish some protocol that says, all male physicians must wear kilts to work. And if you don't do that, they can fire you immediately, because that's a protocol that was established time to time. Physician makes any action or engages in any activity detrimental to the interests of employer. If someone comes in with chronic back pain and you say, I'm gonna give you Motrin instead of your Dilaudid 4 milligram every 3 hours, I'm not gonna refill that Dilaudid prescription, they may go and complain to administration, which may be detrimental to the interests of the group that's employing you. For doing that, you could be terminated immediately. So you see how these subjective for-cause terminations can turn around and bite you for something relatively minor. Malpractice insurance. This is another important part of the contract. Every contract should have a malpractice insurance policy included. Between 1 in 10,000 and 1 in 40,000 patients files a malpractice claim. 8 to 12 times as many patients have a compensable injury. So this is a deal breaker. Every emergency medicine contract needs to provide malpractice insurance to the physician. Everyone, no questions asked. And they either have to provide occurrence-based insurance, which we'll go to in just a second. So if they don't, let's go to these the two types of insurance. So there's claims-made insurance and there's occurrence-based. Claims-made is in effect when the claim is made. So if you're working for 1 year between the year 2000 and 2001, and then you go and work for another company, if you have a claims made policy, your insurance terminates when you leave in 2001. So if somebody makes a claim against you in 2002, you're not covered unless you buy a tail insurance. Occurrence-based policy is in effect when the injury occurred. That's why I call it occurrence-based. So if you're in that, pardon me, if you're working between 2000 and 2001, you leave, and then they make a claim against you in the year 2002, you're still covered if you have an occurrence-based policy. You're not covered if you have a claims-made policy unless you have tail insurance. And tail insurance is very expensive. So if a contract is going to offer you a claims-made policy, they also need to offer you tail insurance so that you're covered for all the actions that you took while you were working and earning money for that group or the hospital. If they don't provide tail insurance, it's expensive. You're talking $30,000 to $50,000, which is due in one lump sum. Right after, usually it's due within 30 days after the insurance terminates. So most of you aren't going to have an extra $30,000 to $50,000 laying around. So it's a deal breaker if they don't either offer you occurrence-based insurance or they offer you claims-based insurance with a tail. Next on the hit list. Oh, and then the policy limits, $1 million, $3 million, just means $1 million. They're going to cover you for a maximum of $1 million per occurrence and $3 million per year, which isn't really as important. You want the $1 million part. If they're offering you, now some states like Indiana, they've got a statutory limit on the amount of liability for a doctor, so the statutory limit is $250,000. So you want to get a certificate of insurance showing you what the limits are. So here's what a certificate of insurance looks like. And you can see here it's $1 million and $3 million, but that's for general liability and commercial. You go down to the bottom and it says $250,000 per incident, $7.5 million in the aggregate. That's for the whole hospital. So even though $250,000 seems like it shouldn't be that way in Indiana, that's the maximum that a doctor can be liable for, so that's all the insurance you need. So just make sure that you're aware of what the limits are in the state, and if they don't have any limits, then you need $1 million coverage minimum. Integration clause. Sample integration clause language says, this agreement constitutes the entire agreement of the parties respects the matters contained herein and supersedes any and all previous discussions, agreements, et cetera, et cetera, and so on. So why is this important? Suppose you go to your interview and they say, we've got four locations, we're going to have you practice at this one. If that's not in writing in the contract, it's not enforceable if there's an integration clause there. Suppose they say, okay, we're only going to schedule you for one night per month. If that's not in the contract and there's an integration clause in there, they're not bound by it because that integrated the contract supersedes whatever agreements have been made prior. What if they say, all right, we're going to have double coverage with a physician, and then you get to work and there's an NP or PA, and you don't want to work with an NP or PA. That's an issue, but if it's not in writing in the contract, you can't hold them to it. So there's all these types of things that if there's an integrate, it's generally a good idea to get in writing regardless, but if there's something that's important to you that you've agreed to that isn't in the contract, just write it in and initial it. Make it binding on them. So how do you minimize the effect of integration clause? You get everything in writing, otherwise you'll end up broke and living in a cave on some mountain. If it was promised to you in the contract, and it is, or if it's promised to you before you got the contract and it isn't in the contract, you write it in the margins. Indemnification clauses. Okay, indemnification clauses happen to be a pet peeve of mine. And basically, an indemnification clause says something to the effect that each party here too agrees that he, she, or it, because the hospital is going to be hiring a lot of eunuchs apparently, shall indemnify the other party here too, and that party here too shall hold the other party here too, harmless from any liability, cost, damage, judgments, losses, reimbursement, yada, yada, yada. So what does this mean? This means that if there's any harm that flows from what you've done in the hospital, that you have to reimburse the hospital for everything. If they get a $10 million judgment against them based on something you did and you sign an indemnification clause, guess who's responsible for it? Not the hospital, you are. Suppose there's civil monetary awards. Suppose they got nailed for a HIPAA violation and you were in any way tangentially involved in it. And they have to pay millions of dollars in government fines. Guess who's got to pay for those fines? Not the hospital. The hospital may, but they're going to come after you for it. You're liable for it. What if they decide, what if you're employed as an independent contractor, the IRS comes back and say, no, they're employed and we want all the back taxes. Who's going to be responsible for that? You will if you sign an indemnification clause. EMTALA violations, if they get fined for an EMTALA claim and you sign an indemnification, you're responsible for it. So here's just another example, power of attorney for payment. Anybody that works in a hospital in Illinois has to sign one of these. And basically at the bottom it says, I understand and acknowledge that I retain full responsibility for all claims submitted to the Department of Public Name, Public Aid under my name. So in other words, they're submitting the claims on your behalf. You're responsible, and if they do something illegal, if they bill the government level 5 charges for kids with runny noses and the government comes back and comes and sues them, guess who's responsible for it if you sign the indemnification clause? You are. So people come up to me and they say, you know what, Dr. Sullivan, my contract has an indemnification clause in it. What should I do? And I say, well, here, I'll show you what you should do. Here's contract. It's, boy, I get $1 million a year. That's great. I only have to work 3 shifts a month. Oh, indemnification here. This is what you do. Next. So get rid of them. Don't hit yourself in the head with it. Don't sign the contracts if they've got indemnification clauses in them. Nothing good will happen from signing an indemnification clause. Don't do it. Okay. Duty to supervise. This is becoming more and more of an issue lately. And what the contract is saying is the physician, you're going to act as a supervising physician for everybody else in the emergency department. So you're going to keep an eye on the nurses, the physician assistants, the nurse practitioners, and everybody else that's working in there. How can that be a problem? If there's a, if you're supervising a physician assistant, the Illinois Physician Assistant Supervision Act states, which the physician assistant is operating under, states that the supervising physician maintains the final responsibility for the care of the patient, performance of physician assistant. So if they do something wrong, who's responsible? They agree to supervise the physician assistant. Whoever agrees to supervise. I'll give you a good case. There was a doctor at a hospital that I used to work at who notoriously didn't come in and do rounds, and he sent his nurse practitioner in to do that. And the nurse practitioners had the same thing in Illinois. The nurse practitioner missed something on a patient that was going to surgery. The patient ended up dying in surgery, and there was a $15 million judgment against the physician assistant. The doctor threw the nurse practitioner under the bus and said it was all her fault. She didn't tell me about it. She didn't call me about it. I knew nothing about it. And threw her under the bus, and there was a judgment against her for $15 million. What did he just do? He just dove under the bus with her because he was responsible for supervising her. So in his attempts to try to get out of this lawsuit, he actually made it worse on himself. So he was liable for the judgment. Improper delegation of authority. There's a case in another lecture that I do called Gills versus Cardio TVB Surgical Associates, where the surgeon would open up. He would finish doing the important part of the surgery, and then he'd walk out of the surgery and go do the next one and tell the PA to finish up. Well, the PA screwed up a case, and the person ended up losing their leg, and the court said, physicians don't have carte blanche to delegate any and all tasks to an assistant. You have to be careful. And then there's this whole issue about informed consent. Does the patient really know that a physician assistant is the one who is working or who is taking care of them? And here's a thing from the New York Times a year or two ago, where a nurse practitioner got her doctorate degree, and she comes in and says, hi, my name is Patty McCarver, Dr. Patty McCarver, and I'm your nurse. So there are a bunch of issues with informed consent when a nurse practitioner goes in and says, hi, I'm Dr. So-and-so, I'm your nurse. Does the patient really know that a nurse is taking care of them, or a nurse practitioner is taking care of them? Important point. One other case, just from supervision from the emergency department. 62-year-old male with a severe headache for 5 days. Had a hernia repair and epidural anesthesia. The PA examined the patient, and the court opinion kept saying the PA was only 6 months out of PA school, thought he had a spinal headache. And the emergency physician never evaluated the patient, agreed, and sent him home. Blood patch was performed. The patient came back later that evening. The headache was worse, and then he died from a ruptured subarachnoid hemorrhage. The neurosurgeons at the hospital were so upset with the doctor and the PA that they testified. You almost never see that. One doctor in the same hospital testifying against another doctor. They were so ticked off about it that the doctors in the same hospital testified against the emergency physicians, and they ended up being a $2.15 million settlement. And then just earlier this month, the medical board filed a complaint in Las Vegas against the doctor saying that the doctor didn't supervise the PA close enough. The PA was giving out unnecessary prescriptions, and the medical board said it constituted medical malpractice not to supervise the PA. My personal opinion is that this is going to become a lot more significant in the coming years as more and more PAs and more MPs are taking sole care of the patients, and you're just forced to sign the charts at the end of your shift. There's going to be more and more of this coming along, so just be careful. The last slide is just about negotiating tactics. So there's a bunch of different negotiating tactics, and I'm not going to give you guys all my secrets, and I know that there are people from groups that are sitting in the back, and I'm not going to give them my secrets either. So I'm just going to talk about a few of them to see how they can get you to sign contracts and how you can try to get a better deal. So what the hospitals and the groups often do, one of the biggest ones is a deadline. They'll say, you have to sign this contract by August 30th or it's null and void. And that puts a time pressure. You say, my God, I got to get this done. I got to find somebody. I got to sign this. And we're not going to have time to negotiate. Most of the time, the deadlines aren't written in stone. So if you're moving forward in trying to negotiate the contract and finalize the contract, I've never seen a group that doesn't extend the deadline. The reason the deadlines are there is because they don't want you stringing them along while you're looking for it in another place and say, okay, I got this contract in my back pocket. I can sign it if I want to, but I'm still going to try to find something better. So they either want you to move on and take the position there or find something else, but not string them along. This is our standard contract. So they may give you a horrible contract that's got indemnification clauses in it and doesn't give you malpractice insurance coverage, all these things, and they'll say, this is our standard contract, everybody signs it. And baloney, it's not true. There's no contract that is not negotiable, and if they refuse to negotiate a contract because that's our standard contract, don't sign it, go somewhere else. Even there are some contract management groups that'll have a partnership or an operating agreement, and that can't be changed, but they can always add an addendum to that that changes the wording within that contract. So they may not be able to change the operating agreement, but they can add an addendum that'll give you the other things that you're looking for. So if they say it's a standard contract and they won't give you what you want, find another contract. There's plenty of them out there. The walkout. They may say after a while, you know what, we've decided, if you don't, we don't hear from you tomorrow, forget it. We're not going through with this. And that just, again, it's a way to put time pressure on you. Say either, I've got to make a decision. And maybe they say they got somebody else that's looking at the position. They may say, whoever signs first is going to get it, and we're walking out of the other person. So just be aware sometimes that's a negotiating tactic that they use that's not really, they may not have somebody else, but sometimes it's legitimate, so you've got to determine if you get faced with that tactic, whether or not you're going to bite and sign the contract, or whether you say, I'm going to look for something else. What are a couple of things that you can do to use to your advantage when you negotiate a contract? You can say, I want these things, or else I'm going to go sign with another group. But you need to pretty much have another group in your back pocket that you can sign with, because they may call you bluff and say, okay, we're not changing it. Thanks for the interview. So if you're gonna threaten to walk out of negotiations, make sure you've got a backup. And then the red herring just means you take something in the contract that doesn't matter to you. Say the contract says you're gonna have to work an equal number of nights and day shifts, and you don't care, but you keep saying, I got a family, I only want to work days. I can't work nights. And they say, well, that's our standard. Everybody works nights. I can't do it. And then you get something else in the contract that you really want. You say, okay, I'll give it. I'll work nights if you give me this. So basically, you're trading something that you don't really care about for something you do care about, and it's making you look like you're giving on the contract. So that's called the red herring. And there's a lot of other things to do. The biggest thing with negotiating is, at least what I try to do when I negotiate a contract, is I try to make it win-win. I try to make things palatable for both the doctor and for the group. So, and if you can get to that goal with when you're negotiating a contract, then you're pretty much set. And that is it. So if there are any questions, we kind of ran a little bit over, so if you've got any questions, I don't know, I can hang out in the corner for a little while and talk to you. If you've got any, you can also write me, my website's there. I would be happy to write you back if you have any questions about contracts. And that is it. Thanks for the attention.